So having finished the introduction to Hebrews, we're going to begin in chapter 1, and I'll begin the chapter by covering the first section of our outline in verses 1 to 3 that tells us that Jesus brings a revelation that's superior to that of the prophets. So verse 1, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets, in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. Verse 3. He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And he sat down because his work was completed. That's what we normally do. After we've finished a demanding task, we sit down. Although it's important to note that in the Old Testament, no priest had ever sat down in the presence of God before. And so, just to back up, it's interesting that we discover seven astonishing things said about Christ in verses 1 to 3 that I read. One, that God has spoken to us in his Son. Two, that Jesus, his Son, is the heir of all things. Three, that through him he made the world. Four, that he is the radiance of God's glory. Five, that he is the exact representation of his nature. Six, that he upholds all things by the word of his power. And seven, that he made purification for sins. And in addition, in these short verses, the writer makes it very clear that he's presenting Jesus as a prophet, a priest, and a king. In verse 2 we read, in these last days God has spoken to us. And that was the role of the prophet. God has spoken to us. Jesus is a prophet. In verse 3 we read, when he had made purification for sins, which is the role of the priest. And again in verse 3, that he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, speaking of his enthronement and reign as king at the Father's right hand. And this is characteristic of the book. It's dense, rich, and profound material. And here Jesus is identified as prophet, priest, and king in just three verses. And I need to pause here just to say that we could have a whole course of study just on the first three verses of Hebrews 1, as here we find some of the richest Christology in the whole New Testament. Statements like, through him, that's through Jesus, he made the world, he made the cosmos, and that he, Jesus, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his nature. Astonishing, astounding. And he upholds all things. He upholds all things in the cosmos by the word of his power. And these are incredible claims about the person of Jesus, and I'm somewhat torn at this point, because on the one hand I'd like to unpack them as it's such great stuff, but on the other, if I do, we'll never reach the end of the book. However, I do cover similar verses in my study on Colossians in some detail. You can find them in chapter 1 of the series. And so for the sake of time, I'm going to press on, although I pass over this theological mountain range with great reluctance. Then, in the second section of our outline, In verses 4 to 18, he presents Jesus as the one who is superior to angels. And he'll use 7 Old Testament passages to demonstrate this. Now, the fact that Jesus is superior to angels is not a pressing theological issue for most of us, and hardly even seems relevant today. However, for those receiving the letter, it was a huge debate, and perhaps would parallel the debate today over whether Jesus is the only way to God, or are the claims of other religions equally valid. And all of us would enter passionately into such a debate, as it becomes a very pressing issue for those of us living in multicultural societies. And in a similar way, the issue of Jesus as one who is superior to the angels would generate the same kind of heat among the Hebrew believers as the issue of is Jesus the only way to God does among us today. And as an aside, many of the verses he uses here actually do apply to whether Jesus is the only way to God. In addition to answering the question of the superiority of Jesus to angels. So the issues may not be the same, but the answers are very similar. If it's true for the one, it's true for the other. And so these verses, while we may get something slightly different from them than those who read them for the first time, they are equally relevant. So he begins, in verse 4, presenting Jesus as one who is superior to the angels, by saying that the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs, than the angels. Then he backs this up in verse 5 by quoting from Psalm 2. For to which of the angels did God ever say, then he quotes from Psalm 2, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And I should point out that the word begotten in the Old Testament does not necessarily have the thought of being born or having a beginning. It simply means being elevated to a new status by God. And we find in Acts 13, actually it's verse 33, which is Paul's first recorded sermon, by the way, that Paul uses this very verse from Psalm 2 to describe the resurrection of Jesus, not to teach that Jesus had a beginning in time. So Paul says in Acts 13 that begotten in Psalm 2 means that Christ was elevated to a new status as Lord of the world by his resurrection from the dead. He says that, and I'm quoting now Acts 13, that what God promised our fathers, he has fulfilled for us their children by raising up Jesus, as it's written in the second psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you. So in using the word begotten of Christ, Paul and the writer of Hebrews do not mean that Jesus had a beginning, but rather that by his death and resurrection, God has given him a new status as the Lord of the world and exalted him as the God-man to his right hand. Then in verse 5, the author's second Old Testament quote in presenting Jesus as the one who's superior to the angels is 2 Samuel 7:14, which says, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. Now the immediate application here in 2 Samuel is to Solomon, as the kings of Israel were called God's sons. However, when we read 2 Samuel 7, we find that there are dimensions in the passage that Solomon could never fulfill. For instance, it says that the throne of Solomon would be established forever. But as we know, the Davidic kings came to an end in 586 when Judah went into captivity, and there simply weren't any more Davidic kings from the line of David and Solomon after this. However, all the dimensions of 2 Samuel 7 were completely fulfilled. They were filled full in the person of Jesus, whose throne is established forever. And when he was baptized, you remember, the heavens were opened and the Father spoke, saying he was his beloved Son, which was fulfilling the words of 2 Samuel 7, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. And then the third quote that he uses in presenting Jesus as the one who's superior to angels in verse 6 is Psalm 97, verse 7, which he quotes from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which, by the way, is not the same as the Masoretic text used here by the NIV. But I believe that the Septuagint, the Greek translation, is the better of the two at this point. So verse 6, and again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, and then he quotes Psalm 97, let all the angels of God worship him. And I should mention that just as the word begotten does not mean that Christ had a beginning, in a similar way, being called the firstborn does not mean that there was a time when Christ did not exist. Again, we find this in the Old Testament, where David is called God's firstborn. That's Psalm 89, verse 27. I'll quote it. I will also appoint him as my firstborn, the most exalted of the kings of the earth. But as we know, David was the youngest of eight brothers, and so was not the biological firstborn. But the Hebrews knew that the phrase was used for one who was given great status in the sight of God. And in this sense, the term is used of Jesus. And because of all this, the angels of God are to worship him. And of course, an Israelite would never in 1,000 years worship anything other than the one true God. And so in quoting Psalm 97, which in the Old Testament is speaking of Yahweh, and saying that all the angels of God should worship Jesus, he is saying with crystal clarity that Jesus is the Yahweh of the Old Testament. As you remember, the creed says, he is very God from very God. And then in verse 7 comes his fourth Old Testament quote in presenting that Jesus is the one who's superior to angels. And he uses Psalm 104, verse 4. So verse 7, and of the angels he says, and here comes the quote, who makes his angels winds of fire and his ministers a flame of fire. And the word ministers or servants here is still referring to the angels, not to believers. So he seems to be saying here that compared to Jesus, the one exalted to God's right hand, the angels are only ministers or servants. And although they serve as God's wind and fire in accomplishing his purposes, this is nothing compared to the purposes accomplished through his beloved Son. So again, he's pressing his case for the greatness of Jesus in contrast to that of the angels. And then in verse 8 comes his fifth Old Testament quote, as he continues to press home his points that Jesus is superior to angels. And now he uses Psalm 104, verse 4. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And again, this is an astonishing affirmation of the deity of Christ, as here he is unambiguously called God by the writer of Hebrews. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. Just amazing, amazing. Then next, in verse 9, he tacks on a quote from Psalm 45 to emphasize that this throne and scepter is now a rule of righteousness and joy. Here it comes. This is the quote from Psalm 45. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. And just as an aside, we read of David being anointed three times, once in secret by Samuel, and then as king over Judah, and finally his third anointing as king over all Israel. And in a similar way, Jesus, David's greatest son, is anointed three times. He was anointed, you remember, for his ministry at the Jordan when the Spirit descended as a dove. Then he was anointed for his death and burial. You remember the woman with the alabaster jar. And thirdly, anointed as Lord of the whole creation when he ascended to the Father's right hand, and when, in the words of Psalm 45, he was anointed with the oil of gladness above his fellows, expressing the unspeakable joy in heaven over his victory over sin and death and his resurrection and ascension to the Father's right hand. And next, in verse 10, comes his comes quotation number 6 from the Old Testament. As I said, there'll be 7, so we've got to number 6. Again, presenting Jesus as the one who's superior to angels. And this time, he uses Psalm 102, verse 25. And you, O Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Two astounding things are said in this quotation. First, the word Lord, Yahweh, used in Psalm 102, is again applied to Jesus here, in the quote from Psalm 102, here in Hebrews 1:10. And second, in giving Jesus this title, it also again becomes a crystal clear statement that Christ was the creator of the heavens and the earth. And the quote goes on to say, you, Lord, speaking of Christ, in the beginning laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. And this is why Jesus is superior to the angels. They were not the creators of the cosmos, but the risen Christ was, Jesus, Mary's boy, the carpenter of Nazareth, is the one through whom all things were created. Again, these things take your breath away. And perhaps I should add here that we can assume that part of the heresy the author of Hebrews is attacking is also that which Paul attacks in Colossians, where he writes in chapter 2, let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in the worship of angels, which was part of the heresy, as I say, in Colossians that Paul had to counter. And such worship is simple ignorance of who the person of Jesus truly is. Then finally, his seventh quote in verse 13 is from Psalm 110, verse 1. But to which of the angels has he ever said, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet"? A king's firstborn son would normally be the one who would sit at the right hand of his father. And this is exactly where Jesus is today. As we read, you remember, in verse 3, when he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. And this is where he will remain until his enemies become his footstool, and until the whole cosmos is in submission to his authority and reign. So by way of seven Old Testament quotations, the author demonstrates that Jesus is superior to any and every angel. And as I've pointed out, although here the author is simply pointing out the superiority of Jesus to the angels, these quotations are astounding in giving us a description of the deity of Christ. And if this is all we had in the book of Hebrews, it would be, as we say, worth its weight in gold. Now, I won't be covering every verse in the book, as it would make the series very long. And so I'm going to move on to the next chapter. But again, I need to say, be sure to read the whole book for yourself, as there are some marvelous verses that I skip over, not only for the sake of time, but also to stay within the main thrust of the complex arguments, as the main thrust of the book would be harder to grasp if we stopped and covered every verse in detail. And so with that, we'll close down chapter 2 and then move on to chapter 3. Sorry, I should have said I'll finish chapter 1 and move on to chapter 2.